From the Land de Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 8th day of September 2022. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll review how a couple of different folks, one from Syngenta and then the Secretary of Agriculture, are thinking about U.S. EPA as it's related to atrazine and farm chemicals. That'll be somewhat of a review, but we've not put the two together as a juxtaposition yet this week. And then we'll continue on with the Secretary of Agriculture and hear from him about biofuels and the Inflation Reduction Act. After that, we'll return to some of the conservation measures in the IRA and how Ivan Dozier, who heads up the Illinois NRCS, Natural Resources and Conservation Service, and how it will be implemented across the state. And we'll wrap up our time together by celebrating 10 years of the Illinois Nutrient Research and Education Council on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world online at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I'm out of the office, so no update at the commodity markets at the CME Group today. Let's begin by reviewing some of what we heard from the Senior Director of Federal Government and Industry Relations, Mary Kay Thatcher, of Syngenta yesterday. We started out with her by asking about the EPA and some of the issues there related to pesticides.
I think we have to be really keeping a close eye on those folks because, there's been a trend to really kind of move away from science. And I think a lot of concern about what's happening in the court system. And that very much may not be just separate from EPA. But, you know, whether we look at, well, it seems like everything happens in the Ninth Circuit Court out in California these days. So we look at that and we look at things like atrazine coming up. That's a big concern to us right now, where they've gone in and said, hey, you got to cut your atrazine rate. And they've sort of gone to the trend of, if you want to continue to use atrazine, you're going to have to do between 1 and 4 conservation mitigation measures. And they won't be easy. I mean, one of the opportunities is a 100-foot buffer strip. So, but I think we're seeing more of that. We saw it, as you well remember, just a year or so ago on Enlist One and Enlist Duo, but in the end, that didn't end up being imposed on too many counties around the country. Here, we're talking about 70% of the corn and 70% of the soybean acres, sorghum acres, so a big difference.
What is the issue?
Well, this time, I think they're more looking at what's the potential runoff, and that's why they're looking at, could you do conservation mitigation like more buffer strips or contour plowing or different things like that. So they've significantly lowered it. They've also gone in, and I think this really points to the idea that you have, we all have lots and lots of people in Washington who just don't know what a farm is anymore. And it's very true at EPA. I mean, they're saying you're going to lower the amount, you're going to do conservation mitigation. You can only apply 2 pounds per acre. You can't apply it if the soil is moist. And then the one that really kills me is, if your local weatherman says it might rain in the next 48 hours, you cannot apply atrazine. Well, who in the heck is the local weatherman? And, you know, on my farm, I've had the local weatherman say for 3 straight weeks, it's going to rain today. It's going to rain. It never did rain, but that would mean I would be precluded for 3 weeks from applying something. So pretty big impact on farmers.
So that was Mary Kay Thatcher from Syngenta, one of the 3 life science companies still on the planet, large ones, that is, that provide pesticides to agriculture across the planet. Those include Syngenta, Bayer, and Corteva. You also know that I was in a press conference with the Secretary of Agriculture a couple of weeks ago. He was asked about this same topic as it relates to atrazine and pesticides and EPA.
You know, I think my work with the EPA, I mean, first of all, say sort of my philosophy on this. I mean, obviously, I'm not in the business of telling the EPA or any other entity of government how to do their business, because I don't want them telling me how to run the Department of Agriculture. And I don't think anybody on this call wants anybody from outside of the Department of Agriculture to direct me to do certain things because the Department of Transportation or Energy or EPA thinks we ought to do it. So I'm careful in respecting the relationship. But I think first and foremost, we want to make sure that folks at the EPA, as they're making decisions about this, they follow the science. And I think I've received a pretty good assurance from EPA Administrator Regan that is his intent. He wants to be able to follow the science, wherever the science takes us. And, you know, I've heard farmers repeatedly say to me, follow the science. And so I think you've got an EPA administrator consistent who is committed to that principle. And secondly, I think it's important that EPA hears from and hears about the concerns that farmers may have about particular decisions that are forthcoming. There's a situation with atrazine right now. The EPA is not suggesting that atrazine can't be used. They're just saying, look, there are certain risks associated with it. Here's how we think from a labeling perspective, we ought to deal with those risks. Here's our suggestion. We have a comment period. Weigh in on this. Tell us what you think. And so we want to make sure that they continue to do that and make sure that as I hear from producers, as I did today, that I convey that to the EPA of what I'm hearing on the ground. So we want to make sure that the science is followed, and we want to make sure that farmers are heard from. And then after decisions are made by the EPA, regardless of whatever that decision may be, then I think it's incumbent upon the Department of Agriculture to say, okay, now we know what the direction is. How is it going to impact and affect farmers? And is there anything we can do at USDA with the tools we have through NRCS or any other mission area of the department? Is there anything we can do to mitigate, moderate, reduce the costs or reduce the impact of whatever the decision is that's been made by the EPA? And I think if we follow that, if they follow the science, they listen to farmers, and we do our job of mitigating as best we can decisions that are made, then I think at the end of the day, that is the best approach. And I think we have an administrator, I think he's shown from the decisions he's made that he's listening, that he's following the science, and that he understands and appreciates the importance of American agriculture.
That was U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack discussing atrazine and the United States Environmental Protection Agency's proposed rulemaking. Comment period for that rulemaking, by the way, closed earlier this week. Here are four items that rulemaking would put into place. It would prohibit application of atrazine when soils are saturated or above field capacity, prohibit application during rain or when a storm event likely to produce runoff from the treated area is forecasted to occur within 48 hours following the application, prohibit aerial applications of all formulations, and restrict annual application rates to 2 pounds of active ingredient or less per acre per year or less for applications to sorghum, field corn, and sweet corn. U.S. EPA will consider the comments that have been made over the last 2 months before it releases its final rules. The Secretary of Agriculture was asked other questions during that press conference, and one of them pertained to the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and some $500 million that are included in it for renewable or biofuels.
That's correct. $500 million in the blender infrastructure program, which I believe may have started when I was secretary before, and one that we support at USDA and the Biden administration supports. And that $500 million is obviously going to allow us to expand access to higher blends. In addition, continued investment in advanced biofuels. And as you mentioned, the sustainable aviation fuel with tax credits and other incentives. We're seeing quite a bit of interest and quite a bit of activity in that space. And that, again, is an area where the USDA is engaged. We have a number of research centers that are focused on the feedstocks and the efficiency of particular feedstocks for that aviation fuel. We are working on the logistics, if you will, the supply chain that can exist to be able to create the $3 billion by 2030, the $35 billion by 2050. And we're working on our sister agencies. I just had a conversation with Secretary Buttigieg from Transportation, the excitement that they have about resources that they're putting in to the Grand Challenge between DOT and DOE, the Department of Energy, nearly $4 billion, over $4 billion of resources available in grants and loans for those who are interested in producing the sustainable aviation fuel. So, and some big companies that are currently doing that. I know ADM is engaged in this, and many other entities are interested in this. So this is a big deal. And the fact that it is in this Inflation Reduction Act, I think is reflective of the support this administration has provided to the biofuel industry.
That was U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. He was talking there about the Inflation Reduction Act and some of the monies that have been released as it relates to agriculture. There is money as well, as we've heard already this week, for conservation. However, I wonder just exactly how the state of Illinois might benefit from those funds. I caught up with Ivan Dozier of Illinois NRCS, that's the Natural Resources Conservation Service in the state, and asked him about the funding.
Well, I think it's always exciting when we see major pieces of legislation like this that includes conservation and conservation in names of programs that we all recognize, and we know that we have a lot of interest in conservation from our Illinois farmers, and just you know, the opportunity to see. We've known that they can do a lot of things to help on a larger scale. So to see this come out of major legislation like this, agriculture. Most of our programs, our conservation programs, they're voluntary, and the dollars go directly to the farmers to help them put conservation on the land. And so it's through programs like the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, the Conservation Stewardship Program, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, and then also our Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. So it's four solid programs that have been around for a long time. Farmers are familiar. Sign-ups are continuous, so we don't even have to wait on all the details. If people are interested, doesn't take any kind of a risk to come in, say you're interested in the programs, and get your name on the list, and hopefully we can make a difference.
These are cost-share programs that help producers install what kinds of things?
Well, that's right. So the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, we used to call it our Fix-It program. It's the thing that helps those farmers that have existing resource issues, whether it be erosion or nutrient management, even livestock facilities. And then the stewardship program, the conservation stewardship program, is there for farmers that have been practicing conservation, and they're going to continue to do those things and add a few more. And then the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, there's where our partners get into the act and they help us target these dollars to specific areas or specific resources. So a really good thing for partners when you can leverage some of these funds. And then the easement programs, they're a longer term, returning lands to wetlands, returning grasslands, and then also just preserving farmland from encroachment, you know, from urban sprawl. So all good active programs that have been around for a while. Our people are ready to hit the ground if people come in and have questions about them.
Clearly, farmers, landowners will understand how the programs work mostly, and that they are doing some cost sharing with the government in some cases, and they get a benefit from that. What does the taxpayer do as a benefit?
You know, that's an excellent question, and that's why we always say that when you do conservation practices that help give you cleaner air, cleaner water, balanced habitat for wildlife, there's where the entire public benefits. And that's why it's in legislation like this when we look at really literally global issues that agriculture can have, not only an impact on the ag industry, but a greater impact beyond that helps the general public.
Is there a backlog of folks waiting for some of these funds that this will help to clear?
I wish I could tell you that there wasn't a backlog, but there is. There's never enough funds to go around. We always say to have a real impact, whether it's the hypoxic zone or even if we talk about climate, we know the practices that have a positive impact. And we know they work. We just need more of them and a significant amount more. And the farmers in Illinois, the fact that we have a backlog shows that they're interested, they want to do things, and it also demonstrates that these funds will be wisely used.
Sometimes when there's a flush of cash that comes into any kind of organization or to a particular set of taxpayers, that means that sometime in the future they may be in trouble. The 2023 Farm Bill is coming up. These conservation programs are part of it. Is there worry that this will offset dollars that would have been allocated in that particular piece of legislation anyway?
So I think that's always a thing. Anytime you talk about legislation that would come up, the Farm Bill is up. in 2023, September of 2023. So having these existing programs right now so we can hit the ground running, I think is good. And then, yes, definitely, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion as to how these dollars will fit into maybe new programs that are customized more directly to achieve these goals. I definitely think they'll be part of that discussion next year.
That was Ivan Dozier. He is the state conservationist for the Illinois Natural Resources Conservation Service. 10 years ago, the Illinois Nutrient Research and Education Council, or Illinois INREC, came into existence. Jeff Kerwin currently chairs INREC, and Matt Duncan is the vice chair. He was around when INREC was founded and currently chairs the research committee for INREC and represents the IFCA, the Illinois Fertilizer and Chemical Association. I asked the two of them, beginning with Matt, to tell me about the history of INREC.
Yeah, so prior to NREC, you know, we had some legislation that did allow for a small tax per ton to fund research, but the way the legislation was written, those funds basically got swept at random intermittent times. And with nutrient research, you've got to have multi-year research, and you cannot support a grad student or a university researcher when the funding comes and goes without notice. And so NREC fixed that. The legislation that created NREC allowed that the funds that are supposed to go towards research to always go towards research and not be able to be swept. And therefore, we've been able to consistently fund over, well, I don't know how many projects, but we've had over 70 peer-reviewed publications from those projects in the last 10 years.
Tell me about the relationship with NLRS, the Nutrient Loss Reduction Strategy.
Yeah, so a lot of the research that our researchers end up doing, it is going directly towards helping to inform where the state is at meeting those goals.
What's the relationship with the University of Illinois?
So, I mean, University of Illinois is part of some of the research that is funded through NREC. Well, we work with Lowell Gentry on some projects. We also work Edge of Field Practices with Dr. Laura Christensen, looking at bioreactors and saturated buffers. So we're working with, you know, updating the MRTN. We've got projects with Dr. Bilo. We've got projects with NRES and some of Rabin and Caillou and modeling. So there's a whole host of things, funded research that we do at the U of I.
This is important as it's related to where nutrients are going in the field, off the field, in the water supplies. Is it important to the farmers of the state of Illinois?
Yeah, I believe it is, because you have an environmental component that this research looks at, but the other things that most of these projects are also working to get better answers on is nutrient use efficiency and production. And so some of the research that's been funded has gone to updating the nutrient need per bushel. There'll be some new research going towards the soil test components of you know, the guidelines that are used in the agronomy handbook for how much nutrient, you know, where should we be building our soil test levels to, and what's adequate, what's critically deficient, and those types of things. So yeah, so this really goes directly to informing how they are going to do nutrient management directly. The added benefit is it also is informing on what impact that then has on environmental quality and the benefits they can help contribute to by utilizing those updated recommendations.
So the work that NREC is doing with the university, other partners, really does have an impact on water quality, but on the bottom line for farmers as well.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, as I tell people, you know, we look at things throughout the state. We try and be a little bit regionalized so that things that affect Southern Illinois farmers, we address those, you know, middle and northern parts of the state. But I think ultimately it's kind of like there are things that farmers would like to try and things that they use on their operations, and we're helping quantify that a little bit, and we're talking about best management, how to use it economically and efficiently, agronomically, all of those things that we want to do. Because obviously success is measured different ways, and we're trying to provide solutions for farmers for the things that they want to try and do.
Tell me a little bit about this 10th anniversary celebration.
So I think it's a good time to reflect back on what NREC has done. You know, we've spent over $30 million in research to date, 72 peer-reviewed projects, Matt was responsible with or has been part of. And so I think it's, you know, ultimately it's a chance for us to look back and then to show everybody what we do and where we're headed, hopefully.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that has been valuable over the last 10 years is as we've grown as an organization in how we operate and the things we're able to fund, you know, we've been able to, as Jeff mentioned, you know, the publications from the universities. We've also, as NREC, published some guides on turf. There's been multiple guides on cover crops, one on the MRTN. And then we also help to host field days throughout the state. So farmers in the, each local geography can hopefully get to a field day of that where many of our researchers will that are researching in that geography will show up and present on what they're doing. And sometimes the farmers get a sneak peek, right? Because a lot of this data is going to be 3-4 year research. And so to get a full conclusions takes at least that long. But a year or two in, the researchers have can share a little bit about, hey, this is the direction things look like there that we're finding. And so it's been a really interesting component, I think, to be able to combine both that research and the education and outreach portion.
Is this organization unique in the nation or in the Midwest?
We were. I think we might have been the first at the time that we became 10 years ago. Iowa now has a similar organization, and each one is a little different in how they're structured and organized and what their bylaws are. But yeah, we are no longer unique. There are a couple other states that have kind of seen what we've done and have figured out ways to do something similar.
To add to that, I think one important thing to remember, we are the only state, though, that is farmer-funded. A lot of the NRECs that are in existence today, like Iowa, are funded through legislature. We're actually, it's an assessment on fertilizer that 75 cents of that goes towards NREC and the research that we do. So we are unique in the United States as far as farmer-funded, which shows the commitment that agriculture in Illinois has to working with these issues.
How unique is your basis in the Illinois nutrient loss reduction strategy across these types of organizations?
We're always just striving to find ways to improve the NLRS, to validate it a little bit. You know, we are a cross-section of people involved in NREC. All the commodity organizations are part of it. We have environmental groups as part of our board. We have department people from the USD or from Illinois Department of Ag, and we have the Illinois EPA. So I think that's what another thing that makes us very unique is that we have all of the stakeholders in place of representation. And I think that is another unique feature to us, that but it helps us tackle the issues and talk about it and figure out where we're headed as far as research and problems that we want to look at.
That last voice you heard belongs to the chair of the Illinois Nutrient Research and Education Council, Jeff Kerwin. He was joined by Matt Duncan. He's the vice chair of Illinois NREC. You may learn more about Illinois NREC online at illinoisnrec.org. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.